Welcome to the jungle, circa 2017. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to this edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be back with you again, Barry, here in the studio. It's going to be an interesting show this week, we think. And, of course, you're free to form your own opinion, and we'd like to know about it. I'll give you the address here, www.principledpolicy.com. People have told us we don't give it enough. So www.principledpolicy.com, principledpolicy.com. There's a lot of stuff going on, and we were just discussing off-air the fact that we've had very little trouble filling airspace, and probably it's going to be like that for at least the next 4 years, because the opposition, because they aren't principled in the slightest. Is making life interesting for those of us in the faith community. And let's not forget, it's very interesting to see how some members of the church have been co-opted and are willing to align themselves with people who would remove all vestiges of religious liberty from them. They're just fine with that. As far as they're concerned, the church should have nothing to do with any activity inside the political or social arena, and therefore they will side with people who would make laws eliminating the First Amendment. And the First Amendment being that Congress shall make no law is the opening phrase regarding the establishment of a religion or interfering with the free practice thereof.
Yeah, prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's right. But, you know, Chuck, as we've seen and we teach, those first five words of the First Amendment are the ones that get ignored the most.
Yeah, Congress shall make no law.
First and foremost, the emphasis is on the fact the federal Congress is who is being prohibited. The shall make no, but shall means it's a directive. It's not a, well, we'd really rather not. It's basically saying, no, you don't have the ability, the authority, or the permission to. Shall make no law. I'm basically saying, forget it, guys. You cannot write a law that infringes on these rights. And, of course, in the First Amendment, the preeminent right, the first right that's mentioned is the right of belief and practice of faith. Yes, that's right. Yeah, to make no law establishing or prohibiting free exercise of religion. And, you know, Chuck, that's very important. But there's also those others in the First Amendment. There's this whole idea of the right to peaceably assemble, the right of a free press, the right of free speech, and then also, of course, the right to petition the government for a redress, which means a response and a fixing of a grievance, which means that there's something that you feel is out of whack or out of order. Now, I think a lot of people get that last one, and maybe it's been abused quite a bit, because mostly what you have petitioning the government right now for redress of their grievances are people whose main grievance is that we have a constitution and that certain people, i.e. Reed Christians, conservatives, and, well, to make it political, Republicans, actually are allowed to say anything in public.
Yes,
and they want
right.
that changed.
Well.
And Chuck, you know, I'm getting to the point now where I have to have a handy guide to understand all the acronyms and special nomenclature that has arisen around basically this leftist progressive movement. For a while now, I hate to admit it, and people who've ever listened to the show for any length of time know I'm fairly plugged in politically and, you know, on what's going on. But for quite a while, I was having trouble because, you know, I just, every other day you're cropping up. It's sort of like the homosexual rights movement. It's like the alphabet soup, and they've decided now with more alphabet letters, so LGBT becomes LGBT, QI, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
LSMFT.
Yeah, TQRSTUVWXYZ or something like that.
SPQR, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, but Chuck, now saying them in order is showing your hidebound traditionalist, patriarchalist, oppressive, male-dominated view of the world.
Oh,
that's the reason why we're jumbling it all up, because you know that's more inclusive, Chuck.
You forgot.
We jumble it all up, and we don't put it in an order.
You forgot cisgendered.
Ah, yes, that's right. The SG, cisgendered. Okay, or CG. It's CIS. That's right. Yeah. Cisgendered.
Yeah.
So CG. Yeah. CG doesn't stand for computer generated graphics anymore. But
as if that's a bad thing. Do you know what that means? Okay. Those of us who have had
cisgendered is androgynous, isn't it?
No. It's just the opposite. Okay. Those of us who have chemical training know the difference between cis and trans. If you know,
good for you. I'm glad you have the training.
Right. If you look at a double bond, okay, this is going to get real a little technical. If you look at a double bond and what they call the side chains are on the same side of the double bond, it's called cis. If they're on opposite sides of the double bond, it's called trans. Okay. So what they're saying is a cisgendered person is the person who is actually expressing the sexuality that they were born with. In other words, that is genetically determined. So a cisgendered person is the person who's actually practicing the gender that they've been assigned by biology. A transgendered person is someone who is practicing some sexuality of something they weren't assigned. That's the difference. So when you hear cisgendered, that's what it means.
Wow. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for that, because first of all, I always think that we should learn something new every day, and I just did, because I really did not understand what that was.
Yeah, cis means same side, trans means opposite side. That's exactly what it means.
I just have to ask, why do we need that word? What they're basically describing, and I'm saying that rhetorically because I know what's going on, but we don't really, rhetorically, all we need to say is normal sexuality versus aberrant or deviant sexuality. That's really what we're getting down to. If you want to change your biology in order to either represent or to, as they call it, transition to another, and I'm going to say, they call it gender expression, and that's really true, because you can't change gender because gender's in your DNA. All you can do is change the outward. And you can take some chemicals and things of that nature and do, you know, hormone therapies and all that good stuff. But when it gets right down to it, at the end of the day, DNA determines.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
Right.
No surgery, no binding, no clipping, cutting, reshaping, blah, 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 whatever it might be, determines. But the point is, and I raised this point, I'm glad you brought this up, Chuck. We're going to get into some of the things we've been looking at to talk about here in a minute. But we're recording this middle of the week, and on Tuesday there was a big prayer rally down at the State House that I was involved in. And afterwards there was a briefing for pastors and leaders with Todd Starnes, who's with Fox News. I'm sure some of our folks have gone over to Fox News and read his weekly column, because he writes on what's happening in the culture related to the persecution of Christianity, you know, where kids can't, you know, draw certain things or bring certain books to school, or, you know, graduating from the school, they can't give a speech if they actually mention the fact that, you know, they're Christian or they've been saved by Christ or they love their Lord. Or the farmer in Michigan who can't sell his blueberries at the community farm market because...
Thank you, East Lansing. As a Michigan State graduate, I can tell you
that's... The... because he won't...
Yeah.
Yeah, East Lansing, yeah. He won't allow homosexual couples to engage in the fantasy of, quote-unquote, a marriage ceremony on his private property. So, therefore, he's no longer allowed to have access to the community farmers market to get a space to sell his products. Crazy stuff, and of course he's suing over that. But Chuck, the reason why, and this is what I brought up to Starnes in the question and answer period, is that the left is setting the vocabulary now in order to advance the normalization or the apparent normalization of their deviancy. If we start talking about cisgendering, Well, cis, like you said, in biology, cis and trans, they're opposite. We have to put them on a level in conversation. If we're going to talk about cisgendered and say that that is valid, then by inference, we're saying that trans is also valid. It's just the opposite pole right. of cisgender. But if we say normal heterosexuality, okay, well, then we're dealing with an entirely different ball game, because obviously homosexuality and transgenderism are deviations from the norm. So once we set a norm, anything outside the norm becomes a deviation. And that's truly what this whole sexual movement is a deviation. And that really becomes apparent. But if we turn and start adopting the vocabulary of those who hate and are in rebellion to God, and we start using terms like, oh, they're cisgender and transgender and what do they, okay, what do they call it? A gender identity, you know? If we start utilizing those terms, we're losing. It's the same thing with the reason why I won't talk about or advance the whole idea of same sex, the word marriage. Marriage has a specific definition by God in His scripture of a man and a woman coming together and joining to form a bond for many reasons, for procreation, for fulfilling a need that God has put in each of them, and to, you know, move forward and create stability for families and then also for churches and communities and cultures.
Well, Pastor Doug Wilson has it correct when he says it's called homosexual mirage.
Mirage, yeah, absolutely. So I don't want to talk about same-sex marriage anymore. I'm going to talk about the same-sex fantasy world, because that's what that really is.
Right.
It is not. It's a deviation. It's not normative. And of course, now I didn't say normal, because once you start talking about normal, then you start talking about value judgments. And yes, there's value judgments involved, but that's another trap that the left tries to get the right into, because that becomes we're going to play moral relativism, and why is my truth any less true than your truth? We get into the whole postmodern issue when we start talking about normal. So we talk about normative, because then the question becomes, how can you, and putting it back on the homosexual advocates, how can you defend or say that something that is a deviation is normative? Because it can't be, by definition. See, folks, we have to be extremely careful with the language. We have to be extremely careful with our logic processes. Because this is a fight, Chuck. It is a fight for the hearts and souls and minds, not of those of us who are showing gray in the beards and at the temples or more, but for our children and our children's children. You wouldn't believe some of the things when I was at that briefing. Starnes was, you know, revealing, and he said he's got some things on his website. I won't, and honestly, some of the stuff he said, I'm like shaking my head, like I'm not even going to go over there and look at that, because I mean that's disgusting. You know, where kindergartners and 5-year-olds are being exposed through the public school system to men dressing in drag, to the normalization of a homosexual or lesbians being a loving couple, and that should be considered
okay.
Normal.
We've talked about this in the past. In the last couple of weeks, we've talked about the idea of forced conversion. How were forced conversions done? It wasn't done in a way where people came in and stuck a knife in your ribs and said you either bow to Allah. Now, some of that was done.
Right.
But the way it was done was taking over the schools and making your kids go to school. Basically, the education of children was taken over, and once you take over the education of little kids and teach them stuff like that, they're force converted.
Oh, absolutely.
We've seen that in our own generation, and by that I mean.
Oh, absolutely.
One of the reasons that young people in churches, for instance, in churches I've attended, one reason that they're all, not all of them, but a huge number of them are homosexual marriage supporters, homosexual mirage supporters, okay with the whole homosexual agenda, why they're Bernie Sanders supporters, you go through it, why they think Jesus was a socialist was because, A, they got it in school if they were public schooled. They got it in school if they were Christian schooled. Because in a lot of cases, Christian schools are baptized public schools, essentially. They're public school curricula that is basically taught by teachers who are nominally Christian in most cases. Oh, and it's even done especially done, believe it or not, in Christian colleges. I know of a specific Christian college. I'm not going to bring it up because I know it's going to bring in a huge amount of complaints if I do.
Oh, come on. Are we concerned about complaints?
Okay.
Honestly, I
know what's going on.
Okay. Chuck, it opens the door to look at their thinking.
I know what's going on at Mount Vernon Nazarene University. And you and I both know it because we got thrown out of Mount Vernon Nazarene University for teaching a class on the Constitution.
Right. Yeah, our sponsor group was basically told that they couldn't host us anymore.
In fact, they were not going to let us finish the class. We were going to have to find another venue, and somebody basically intervened and said, no, you're not doing that. But essentially, Mount Vernon Nazarene University, I know what's going on up there. They're teaching emergent church. They're teaching homosexual mirage acceptance. All kinds of they're teaching Christian socialism. They have Ron Sider in there regularly in the chapel. They have emergent church leaders in there in the chapel. And people from the opposite side really aren't given much of a chance. In fact, guys like you and me who are on the opposite side got shown the door at Mount Vernon Nazarene University because we were, quote-unquote, intolerant. Actually, it had to do with the people who sponsored the course that we were teaching. They didn't like their view on the war between the states, and therefore we got shown the door. And now, let me ask you a question, Barry. What does Matthew 18 dictate be done when you've got a complaint against a person? What's the whole idea behind Matthew 18?
Matthew 18, the whole idea is if you got a complaint, you come to them privately, and if that can't be settled, then you bring two or three others together, who are involved or understand the situation. And if the person is in sin and they won't repent, then you bring them before the church.
We actually demanded, A, to know who had filed the complaint, because you have a
Absolutely.
Right to face your accuser, and B, we demanded a hearing, and we were allowed neither. So that's the kind of thing that your kids are learning in Christian colleges, folks. If you think that your kids are safe because you're sending them to a Christian college, you're sending them to a place that is just basically a step down from sending them to a state university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, speaking of our tap in that, welcome to the jungle, Chuck, it really seems as I'm looking around, and, of course, we know everything that's been going on with all the ISIS attacks and, of course, around Ramadan. We've had, London was attacked this last week. There was an attack in Paris, et cetera, et cetera. And there's probably going to be, you just anticipate possibly more attacks like the one that happened at Ohio State here on U.S. soil. Individuals who are involved in, Islam, driving vehicles into crowds in order to maim, hurt, and kill people and to, advance their cause. But you really don't even have to look that far to see that, and you and I talked about this, what feels like our culture spinning into this whole idea of, I'm assuming that most of our listeners have never seen this movie, and both of us are going to put a big disclaimer out there. We're not suggesting or asking that you go watch this movie.
Don't go see it.
It's pretty vile. It's called A Clockwork Orange. It was filmed by Stanley Kubrick back in 1971. But it's about a futuristic society, set in England, but similar to what we have here, where the biggest pastime for the young people is to drug themselves up and then go out and look for how much mayhem they can cause, and they call it a bit of the old ultraviolence.
Yes.
In other words, they go out and they try to do something extremely violent to people in order to have a good time.
Well,
and of course, the culture then is trying to rehabilitate them, but they seem to rehabilitate them into just being worse. And that seems to be where we're going to, because, you know, Chuck, you and I were looking at this, and there's a report coming off of Breitbart News about a and again, this gets back to my whole idea that I need a guide, because, you know, along with cisgendered, we've got a couple other phrases or acronyms that honestly it took me a little while to figure out what they were talking about when I first read them. And one is SJW. If anybody's ever come across yes. that in anything you've read online, et cetera, and the writer, you know, didn't take the time to stop and actually let you know what that acronym stood for, SJW. And unlike WSJ, which is the Wall Street Journal's acronym, this is SJW, which is a little bit backwards and mixed up, but means Social Justice Warrior. These are the leftist progressives, younger people mostly, but there are some older people involved, the leftist progressives who believe that it's okay to enforce their code of conduct, which means you can't speak out positively about Christianity, about ethnic differences. You can't, quote-unquote, culturally appropriate by, say, a white person wearing their hair in cornrows, because that's culturally appropriating African-American.
Another phrase, cultural appropriation.
Cultural appropriation, that's another phrase that's got to go in the handbook. But you've got all these things, but these social justice warriors believe that they need to, and these are some of the people that you see cropping up when there's, and we saw this during the campaign with rallies with the Trump group, the guys who rush up on stage trying to, you know, injure the candidate, etc. When you're hearing about all these brouhahas and fracases at campuses, usually the SJWs are involved. And of course, we've got one now where, honestly, you and I both read it and we both came to the same conclusion immediately. My goodness, we are living in the Clockwork Orange environment.
Okay, I want to draw a parallel real quick, if you don't mind.
Sure, please do.
Okay.
No, I don't mind at all.
For those of us who have seen Clockwork Orange, and again, do not go see it. Do not rent it.
Do not rent it. But, do not look it up online.
Okay,
do not do any of that stuff.
Do you remember the uniform? Do you remember the uniform that the bad guys wore, the young people wore? They wore a white a white outfit.
They wore white shirts with white pants with black suspenders and a bowler hat.
And a mask.
And a mask, that's right.
So what do for instance the Antifa? Again, another phrase for
another phrase. Let me segue just real quick. Up until maybe about 2 weeks ago, Chuck, when I saw that being bandied about, I had no idea what they were referring to until somebody spelled it out in an article, and I'm like, anti-fascist.
Anti-fascist.
Okay.
Okay. So what do the Antifas wear? They wear a black uniform
With a mask.
With a black mask. Yeah, the in Clockwork Orange they wore a white mask in the with a long nose, so it's not exactly a parallel. But in the Antifas wear black clothes and a black mask. And so again, not that far off. It's stunning how sometimes science fiction movies, and I would call A Clockwork Orange more or less a science fiction movie. It was a social commentary at the time, but how predictive it has become.
Yes.
So I didn't mean to interrupt what you were going on about, but I wanted to draw that parallel because
I jumped in too, but you were going back to the Antifas and that just reminded me that that's another entry. I mean, my goodness, pretty soon you could probably put together a small dictionary of all of these appropriational terms. But going back to what we're talking about, and this is on Breitbart, and if you go over there, if people have heard, there was a movement about having a no whites on campus day at some of these liberal colleges across the country, especially one out in Washington State called Evergreen State College. Okay? So if your kid to Evergreen State College, maybe you should listen up and maybe persuade them to look at another choice. But at Evergreen State College, they had a brouhaha because some of the students, I wouldn't say all of them, because I don't think that even though they think they're representing everybody, they're probably not. They wanted to have this movement where they had a no whites on campus day. So if you were white, whether you were a student, a staffer, or faculty, there was supposed to be a day when you were barred from the campus, that you could not be on campus. Well, one of the professors said, forget this noise. I'm not going to participate. I'm going to go and I'm going to teach my class. A professor, Brett Weinstein. Well, of course, when he refused to participate in this joke of an observation, screams went out from the social justice warriors calling for his resignation because he wasn't being a good liberal progressive. You know, he wasn't down for the cause. And so he has kind of started fighting back, and he's now starting to expose something, Chuck, that I think we all ought to pay some attention to, because this is, you look at what's happening about how our children have been and are being indoctrinated into a hardcore socialist progressive anti-God self-esteem movement backed way of looking at the world. And again, what do you get? You get A Clockwork Orange out of that. Stanley Kubrick was an innovative filmmaker, and I forget, was it Anthony Burgess who I believe wrote the book?
Wrote the book, I think so.
Yeah, I wrote this book, and it was basically a condemnation of the late 60s, early 70s British government.
Don't read the book either.
Yeah, don't read the book either. I mean, honestly, just know that we do these things so that you don't have to.
Yes.
But here at Evergreen State, the Professor Weinstein took a photo and he posted it up on his Twitter feed. And what he put the photo of was about, there's about eight people here, mostly not seven of the eight are women, I think. I don't know about the eighth. I'm not really sure, in this era of transgenderism, who knows. But they're all standing around this area, and the vast majority of them are carrying an object. And that's what really brought me home, Chuck, with the Clockwork Orange reference, was they're all carrying baseball bats. And proudly standing there with their bats slung over their shoulder or held, in a way. And they're not, and folks, these are not part of the Evergreen State baseball team, okay?
Yeah.
or the softball team or whatever, because it's not a women's ball team. These are the social justice warriors. And Professor Weinstein basically says that he has actually talked to the administration and to the governor of the Washington State, Jay Inslee, and said, we got a security issue here on campus because we've got credible reports that protesters, these SJWs with baseball bats, have been roaming around the campus for a little bit, and actually when they see something that they feel is a threat to them, they're hitting people with the baseball bats. Now, Chuck, I'm not sure, but I don't think this is, because there's actually a video too. I'm pretty sure this is not fake news, and this is actually happening.
Oh, sure, it's happening. Well, look,
it got to the point where the college administration put out a memo telling the students that, okay, we understand and I loved how they phrase it, you're coordinating a community patrol.
Yes. Don't you love it? It's called a vigilance committee.
A vigilance committee. Okay, folks. Okay. First and foremost, in any sane part of the universe, this would be considered a mob.
Yes.
Secondly, it would be considered vigilantism. Because they're not deputized. They're not posse comitatus. They're not the legitimate militia of the state of Washington. They are a group of individuals who feel that their view of the world has to be enforced by force. And so they've picked up baseball bats, and they're going around basically terrorizing everybody else on campus who will not conform to what they believe is the right thing to do.
Again, it's a vigilance committee. It's essentially a group who, for instance, in the Old West, if there was lawlessness, people would just simply get together and go around and beat heads on anybody who they suspected of a crime, whether that they had proof or not.
Yes.
Essentially, it's also been known in the past, depending on what happened, as a lynch mob.
There's part of that. Now, again, you got to remember, these are feminists, transgenders, homo activists, people of color of various sorts. But these are all, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds who think that they're wiser than everybody else and that they can now set the policies. You know, if they feel that all whites should be removed from the campus for a day in order to show solidarity with those who they believe are being discriminated against because of their ethnicity or their skin color, they should have the right, they believe, to basically just demand it and have it happen.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Now, I'm looking at this memo, and the way it's worded, we are aware of a small group of students. I don't think the group was all that small, by the way. Coordinating,
well, you know, they're just showing one picture of eight students, but yeah, I'm sure that's not all of
it's
them.
Not,
yes,
according to reports. Although you're not getting a lot out of there. Why? There's an obvious reason, because, let's face it, folks, the news has an agenda, and they're not going to tell you that this is going on, because they want to keep it quiet. They stand in solidarity, really, with these students, but they don't want you to know it. Okay, we acknowledge and understand the fear and concerns that are motivating these actions. Really, on a modern college campus, you know who would, you know what would happen if, let's say, your children and my children were in a college situation, and as conservative students, they decided to band together with baseball bats to defend themselves. What would happen to them?
Well, first of all, they'd be arrested by campus police.
Exactly.
Secondly, they'd be expelled by the college. And third, they would probably be civilly and criminally prosecuted.
And they'd be blackballed from any other college. What happens to these guys?
Yes, exactly.
What happens to these guys? They get a little, gosh, you really shouldn't carry baseball bats around campus.
Right, because, and I thought it was hilarious in one sense, because he says the community patrols can be a useful tool for helping people to feel safe. Now, does that mean that the college authorized or granted permission for them to form this community patrol? Or is the administration basically admitting they have no control and they basically are at the mercy of the students?
Well, let's go back to a patrol that was designed to enhance the safety of a community, and it led to the death of someone who was harassing one of those people, and that's the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case. So are they basically saying that, well, it's okay in your case to form community patrols, but not in the other case? It's bad. That's exactly what they're saying.
Absolutely.
You know, this is double standard writ large.
Well, absolutely it is. And just remember, folks, when you hear SJW or social justice warriors, what you're really hearing is basically, because many of these things are happening on college campuses. So, Chuck, think about this first of all. These are individuals who have actually had some privilege in one sense or the other. They are arguably more intelligent than the you know, average person with a high school degree, supposedly, by appearance's sake. Now, I know that's not really true, but by appearance's sake, and they either have the money or they were able to get grants and or loans in order to pursue higher education. You would think all of those things together might make them stop and think a little bit more, but what happens is, because of what they've been trained and indoctrinated in our most of our government school systems, and even many of the private schools, the secondary schools, is the whole self-esteem movement, multiculturalistic relativism, progressivist postmodernist thinking, and entitlement. That's the stew that has been concocted for them that they have been imbibing for years. And so when they get to this place of supposedly of learning, and most of our college campuses now really are not places of learning, they're places of solidifying and making concrete the indoctrination that was started in the government schools. Why should we expect anything different? Why should we not expect roaming bands of hyper-privileged, self-absorbed, narcissistic youth without a rational thought in their head going around trying to enforce their beliefs, mores, and values? We're reaping what we sow.
Yes. Yeah. That's the problem, Barry. And what has happened is we have, as a society, allowed what amounts to the progressive takeover of our universities and our educational institutions. We've sat back and we thought we were safe because we could go to a private institution. Well, as we pointed out, except for a handful, really, it's down to a handful now. When you send your child to a private institution, you're sending them to a baptized public institution. What do I mean by a baptized public institution? They use the same curriculum. They hire the same professors. They hire the same staff, and they use the same books and teaching techniques as the state universities and the expensive private universities, the secular private universities, and they just simply pray over it. They don't really apply a Christian worldview. That's what we're here for. That's why we talk about these Christian worldview issues, because they are being ignored by Christians, and there are actually Christians out there who are saying, there is no such thing as a Christian worldview, and if there is one, it shouldn't have any effect on your culture at all. I'll be quite honest, a Christian worldview without an effect on culture is meaningless.
Yes.
Because as we convert people, as people are converted in and adopt a Christian worldview, if it doesn't have an effect on society, then it's not actually a Christian worldview. Because the transformation of human beings into saved individuals should change everything.
Absolutely.
And what we're being told is, no, it shouldn't change anything. Because after all, Jesus didn't come to change the culture. No, of course he didn't. He came to save people. But what... What are the people expected to do with their salvation?
Let me think. I think Matthew 28 says something about this. If I remember correctly, I think it's later on in the chapter, maybe almost at the end. Yeah, I think it's verses 18 through 20, isn't it? You know, where basically Christ says, you know, I'm going to be with you, but here, go forth and make disciples of all nations, teaching them all I have commanded you, and baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Go ye forth and make disciples, not of individuals, of nations. And it could be means go to all the world and make disciples of people. But when you change people's thinking, why did the Roman government and the Jewish leaders, you know, the scribes, the Pharisees, the, you know, the Sanhedrin, all of those, why were they so afraid of Jesus and his followers?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was even, if you look at the writings of Paul, you know, these are the men who have come preaching and upholding another king, one Jesus. The Roman government was scared to death of being toppled. The Jewish establishment was being upended by the claims of the God of the universe made flesh,
the kingship,
Christ Jesus, who basically said, all authority is given me, and authority or power, depending on the translation you look at, but it all means the same thing. It all means control. All authority is given me in heaven and in earth. Now go ye therefore and make disciples of all nations.
The kingship of Christ is necessarily transformative.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, you get that. But, you know, here we go with the SJWs and the Antifas and everybody else. And, of course, Chuck, you also have, and I wanted to run this to, I know we're going to get close on time here shortly, but, you know, you even have the point where right now we have people in the media, and we talked about this on the last program, Kathy Griffin, the she's not funny comedian, basically, doing a suicide bombing on her own career by doing a photo shoot where she's holding a fake but realistically looking head of the President of the United States, I mean, totally saturated in blood, as if she had just beheaded him. Boy, that blew up in her face. And, of course, when we recorded last week, it was before she announced and did a press conference with her attorney last Friday. And, well, Chuck, I call it doubling down on stupid. That's my favorite phrase to use when somebody just really, you know, what's the old adage? When you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you do is stop digging. Kathy got a bigger shovel.
Yes.
She got a bigger shovel is what she did on Friday.
Yeah.
And basically she came rented out a backhoe. She tried to play the victim. And she said, you know, she played this card that the Trump family was trying to ruin her and were bullying her. Let me think. She stood there with a bloody, dismembered head model of the President of the United States, has continually reiterated the fact that she hates him and is going after him. When reports came out that his 11-year-old son saw this on television and actually thought it was real and, you know, became completely shocked by it, you know, she tried to play off, well, I wasn't after the kid, but less than 6 months ago, she was basically saying she was going to target the kid and try to mess with him. Well, guess what? She goes out here, she does this mewling self, supporting, self-defending press conference with her quote-unquote attorney, and she got herself in deeper, you know, and she, you know, because nobody bought the idea that Trump or his family were bullying her, and this was just something that she thought she was going to do, make some kind of a statement, express her anger and rage at the fact that, you know, Hillary Clinton wasn't president and that Donald Trump's sitting in the White House. And, well, it blew up at her because even her ex-co-host on the New Year's Eve program, Anderson Cooper, who we talked about, basically come right out and said, you know, this was wrong. And, of course, she felt abandoned by him and horrible that, you know, she didn't get support and et cetera, et cetera. And there was a report out of USA Today. It basically was really talking about this press conference. And I thought this was hilarious because it says, quote, Griffin was simply incapable of turning off the comedian switch and rolled on far too long, stepping into enough hot points to rile most every demographic. Was she funny at times? Yeah, for sure. But this was a press conference, not a comedy club routine. And of course, after it blew up on her, she basically canceled all, and I guess one member of the media in the press conference really just went at her. And, you know, because people were starting to get this. This wasn't funny. It wasn't a joke. It wasn't satire. This was somebody's deepest, darkest, most inner held hatred for another human being coming out. And there's no excuse for it. Well, of course, Kathy Griffin now has lost her gig with CNN. They fired her, so she will not be back on, well, as of now, she won't be back on the New Year's Eve program, but we got a long way to go before we get there.
It's six months away. A lot of stuff can happen in 6 months.
Right. You know, and so, okay, we're going to find, but, you know, she's not the only one. There are others. I mean, you've heard about a lot of different things, and, you know, and people, of course, brought up, and we talked about this last week, that people did, you know, they did effigies of Barack Obama during his term in office and did horrible things, lynched and burned and you know, satired and paraded around. And we said those were just as offensive and just as horrible. It's not a funny thing to do because, number one, this is another living human being you're talking about. And we are supposed to have, especially as Christians, we are supposed to respect the dignity of the human being made in the image of God. We may disagree with their philosophies. We may disagree with their politics. We may disagree with their basic worldviews. But we can't say that they don't have worth and therefore should be eradicated. If we do so with someone like a Donald Trump or a Barack Obama, then logically speaking, there's no defense of us not doing so when they're still in the womb. Because the left argument holds then that they don't have worth or value or they're not productive, so therefore they can be eliminated. Or you can be like Peter Singer and some ethicists from Australia that I've been recently reading about, who are advocating now that, you know, parents should have the right up to a certain age, 3 months, 6 months, a year, to, if they just don't feel like the child's going to have any value or is too big of a burden, killing it with no repercussions. Folks, this is the environment we get in. This is the Clockwork Orange postmodernistic world that we're getting into. And, of course, Kathy Griffin's not the only one. For about a month now, before she did her craziness last week, for a month now, the Shakespeare in the Park Company in New York City has been performing a version of Julius Caesar, William Shakespeare's classic play. But Caesar is being portrayed by an actor who looks and dressed, because this is a retaking of it, so everybody's dressed in modern clothes, who is dressed and looks an awful lot like the President of the United States, Donald Trump. And it's not a subtle thing, because they also have the Calpurnia, the character who plays his wife, having a Slavic accent similar to that of yes. Melania Trump. And of course, we all know what happens at the end of Julius Caesar. He's stabbed to death by those people closest to him.
Et tu, Brute.
Et tu, Brute, the yes. Ides of March. Et tu, Brute, the Ides of March. Okay, so is Shakespeare in the Park, which is probably a very liberal, you know, ensemble group headed up by ultra-liberals and funded by liberals, should that statement actually be out there? Yes, Julius Caesar was a historic figure. Yes, that happened to him. But shouldn't it be, even if you were to modernize it, shouldn't it be played more straight on? I mean, yes, we know that Shakespeare's plays, whoever you believe wrote them, were actually written as subtle indictments of political trends that were going on during his lifetime. They were warnings to either the Queen of England or later James, the King of England. You know, he was using historical examples from previous, you know, both in Danish areas with Hamlet and Macbeth, or Macbeth in Scotland, Hamlet in Denmark. And other areas, Henry V, Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, Richard II, all of these were historical plays that had a contemporary point to make about what was going on in and around the governments in the era of Shakespeare's life. And it's fine to do that, and you can do this, but really, let's be quite honest, is it really, artistically honest or appropriate to intentionally put on a performance where the person being stabbed to death is a spitting resemblance and is made up with the tie and the coat and everything else and the blonde hair slicked back just like Trump's and looks a lot like him and actually plays Trump or a Trump-like character in another program called Scandal, which is a television show on ABC, and kill him. I mean, what are we doing with this? Well, I mean, yes, I appreciate culture. I appreciate classics. I'm watching a series right now, with actors talking about, you know, the background and the view of what Shakespeare was doing at the time and why he wrote these plays the way he did. I'm a big fan of the movie Anonymous. I would definitely suggest people watch that. It's a interesting telling of Devere, the Earl of Oxford, actually being the author of the plays and handing them off to an actor by the name of William Shakespeare, who was a real person, but who was functionally illiterate. So it's kind of hard to imagine he would have written such beautiful plays.
Okay, that is so false.
What? Shakespeare was functionally illiterate?
Yes, it's majorly false. He was.
I'm not sure that that's the case because I've not seen any scholarship to show that there's much in the way of any extant writings, and there's only three notations of his signature, and most, and two of them are almost illegible.
essentially, he was well educated because his father was a middle class merchant who made sure that his son got lots of training. It's really nebulous, but I have read some stuff on this, and the idea that Shakespeare was illiterate. In fact, they were surrounded by people who were very well traveled, and in fact, Shakespeare used an Italian neighbor who had a huge library as research material, and that's where he got a lot of his information on for some of the plays that take place in Italy, Romeo and Juliet. Trying to think.
Well, hey, send me your links to that research, because I am fascinated by that, because I've been reading some other pieces, and you know, there's obviously a big debate about that, about who was the actual playwright. But there's a significant argument to be made even outside of the claims of Shakespeare being literate or illiterate, for De Vere actually being the real author of these works.
I think it's
a very interesting debate.
Yeah, I'm not an extensive reader on that particular issue, but I'm always suspicious when somebody else actually wrote him. Yeah. Come on, why do we have to have that kind of 400 or 500 years after the fact, all of a sudden, he didn't really write them? I mean, some of these basically popped up in the 19th century. A lot of these arguments popped up in the 19th century, mm-hmm. and there are about 6 or 7 candidates for who really was Shakespeare. So I'm like, I think Shakespeare was Shakespeare.
Yeah, well, no, I believe that Shakespeare actually was a real person, was an actor. Et cetera, had everything, but I'm not sure. I'm holding, and again, I'm willing to open it up to the idea that it wasn't
real
Shakespeare, but it was someone who was very close and intimate with the court, who utilized that avenue in order to make political statements.
Okay.
to protect their anonymity.
Shakespeare was very interested in making sure that Queen Elizabeth was very pleased with his work because he was a Roman Catholic. And Roman Catholics, mm-hmm. as you know, under the administration of Queen Elizabeth, were in constant danger.
Absolutely.
So he was...
Well, that's the reason why it was poignant about him writing and performing Richard II.
Yes.
You know, because that was really a whole issue about her... and Mary, Queen of Scots.
Richard III, actually. Would have been Richard III. The Hunchback.
No, it wasn't. No, it was Richard II. That was the play about Richard II, Bolingbroke, who became Henry IV.
Yeah.
Who basically attacked and killed Richard, who was an usurper to the throne, who had knocked Bolingbroke, who was the bloodline of the predecessor king, out of line in order to take the kingship for himself.
Yes. Well, he was definitely a usurper king, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. But you know, that was that whole idea of Mary, Queen of Scots, was the, you know, as many saw, the legitimate next in line, and had a claim against Elizabeth being the queen.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting to see this history repeat itself in the writings of Shakespeare. It's very fascinating. If you know a little bit about English history, especially English political history, it opens a brand new venue on these Shakespearean plays that many of us probably read some in high school literature English classes, or actually performed if you were in the drama club or whatever, or if you studied English literature in college. You definitely did Shakespeare. But when you do it with a look to the political and the actually theological viewpoints, as you brought up the Roman Catholicism angle versus the Protestantism angle, it really just brings this depth to the work. And you really start wondering, you know, how edgy was the Shakespeare who wrote these plays? And you come to find out this was a person who really was trying to make some political points.
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely.
Deeply political points.
while essentially sucking up as much as possible to the regime in power.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Which, you know, that's, and I think that's where I think many of our modernists are failing. Now, not that I'm saying that they should, but, you know, Kathy Griffin, the Shakespeare in the Park folks, you have to understand something. Yes, you can critique and comment on the current administration and their foibles and failures all you want to.
Please do.
But at the end of the day, the last thing you should advocate for is their physical destruction.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, there's another play, an off-Broadway play, that depicted life after a Trump impeachment.
Well, and you know what? I have no problem with that one because, okay, that's if you have that big of an angle, you think there's corruption or failures or you know, criminal offenses that are being conducted by the president, that's the proper way of going about it is impeachment.
Well, the whole point is that there are actually people in prison. What's the penalty for impeachment, Barry?
The penalty, if you're impeached, then you're tried by the Senate.
Yeah, but what's the penalty?
And then if you're convicted by the Senate, it is a loss of your office.
Yeah.
The barring of you ever holding an office of public trust under the United States ever again. And you can also be subject, depending on the reason why you're impeached, to criminal charges.
Yeah. Essentially, you lose your office. And you're not allowed to run again. That's essentially it. Well, you know, they're talking about throwing people in jail and blah, blah, blah. I can remember when we taught a Constitution class where we had a student who was very disappointed because he was sure we were going to impeach Barack Obama to show you that it's a bipartisan thing. He was positive that was going to happen, and he says, I want to see him frog marched in handcuffs out of the White House. And I go, well, you better catch him committing an armed robbery or something, because that's not going to happen with an impeachment. Your penalty is limited to loss of office. That's it. Now, you know, if you did something criminal, does that mean you couldn't be tried for that criminal act? And the answer is no. You don't have any immunity as president. You know, it's but this is part of the whole, okay, here's another phrase that we need to enter into the book. Trump derangement syndrome, or TDS.
TDS, absolutely. Forgot about that one.
Yeah, you got it. There's some on either side of the issue here. TDS, Trump derangement syndrome, and this is a perfect example. These plays are a perfect example of Trump derangement syndrome. By the way, what's interesting about that play, the one you were speaking of, is Trump in a business suit and everybody else in like 16th century or 17th century dress. That's some of these, you know, surrealist things are just amazing to me. Oh, you know, how poignant! Everybody else will be in period dress, and he'll be in a Brooks Brothers suit. I see some of these things occasionally. You know, you'll see a film of it on YouTube, and I watch them, and I'm like, you know, I have the capability of suspending belief for the point of a story from time to time. I mean, I've watched Star Trek.
Well, so, yeah, you got to suspend disbelief for a while.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And but some of these are just so surrealist and absurd that they don't make any sense. It's almost like watching a French movie. Yeah. And if you've ever seen some of these guys, like some French movies, art house movies, you're like, what just happened here? What happened in this train wreck? I mean, I'm trying to sort out all the images and it just doesn't make any sense. So, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we're out of time here for this episode. What I want to say is always tune in to Principles and Policies, because you never know when a debate on whether Shakespeare wrote his plays or not is going to break out.
I just want to make sure that they know that we don't pre-script all of this.
That's right.
We look at some things, but, you know, Chuck and I have divergent opinions on numerous things, but, you know, in the spirit of Christian brotherhood, we can discuss our differences without basically pulling an SJW and pulling out baseball bats.
That's right. No baseball bats involved here. And the fact that we're 130 miles apart in our studios doesn't hurt either. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this week. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.